Anything. There we go. Because Pam didn't turn me on.
Okay.
So now I can hear. All right. Welcome back to another week of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with those movers and shakers, the film and TV makers, those producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, production designers, costume designers, editors, sound editors, sound mixers, choreographers, composers, and those wonderful VFX artisans. We talk to them all. Been doing a lot of off-air talking with Emmy nominees. I got a bunch of those that are popping up over the next couple days at BehindTheLensOnline.net. A good many for the incredible work on Palm Royale, which if you haven't seen Palm Royale on Apple TV, you must. You must. It is fabulous. But I've been speaking with the main title creative director, the main hairstylist, Brooke Linton, the choreographer who designed, if you've seen the series, you know what I'm talking about with the beach ball and the Havana Nights ball. Just an amazing job. Well-deserved Academy, Television Academy nominations all the way around. So you're going to just go to the website and the stuff will be there peppered throughout this week. Also have some interviews with some of the creatives on Silo who have garnered Emmy nominations. And of course, a lot of the interviews you've already read or heard here on the show for Emmy consideration includes the production designer and set decorator for Palm Royale, the Alex Friedberg, the costume designer for Palm Royale, and so many others, plus Masters of the Universe. Love my guys at Formosa with their Emmy nomination. I am so happy for all of the Emmy nominees, and we're getting down to the wire. So I am thrilled to be able to speak with It was great to speak with a lot of the potential nominees who became nominees and now with Emmy nominees themselves, but I'm not being greedy when I've already talked to them, pushing them for nominations. I'm not going to take up time and take it away from other people and go for two bites of the apple. I'll settle for one for now. So make sure you go to BehindTheLensOnline.net and check out some of those interviews, and plus some others are up there. New ones are up there as well, with more coming. Now today, very, very excited for today's show. As you guys all know, if you were listening last week, I have no clue who's showing up when for the month of August. Got about 5 different films with talent on all of them, waiting to hear from the publicist who happens to be handling One publicist is handling these 5 different films with different release dates and all. So, waiting to hear who can show up when with a live call into the show. And the other day, out of the blue, late in the day, it was, hey, can Simon call in on Monday? And I think this was Thursday night. Was it Thursday night, Pam? It was Thursday night that I posted. So, yes, Simon Phillips is joining us live at the midpoint of the show to talk about this long-awaited, and we're going to get Simon to clarify the title here. It's either Mickey's Mousetrap or The Mousetrap. I don't know what the final name of the film is, because both are being used, including on the posters and in marketing. So I'm going to have Simon, who's not only the writer, but the producer, as well as a primary actor in this film. And, you know, those of you who have been following the saga of this, when Simon dropped the trailer on January 2nd, 3rd, something like that, caused an internet sensation because of the fact that the beloved Disney early Mickey Mouse version known as Steamboat Willie and the Steamboat Willie films, they entered the public domain on January the 1st. Well, I'm going to talk to Simon, and I'm going to find out just how he had the foresight to come up with a script and this film. Everything that was shot before and kept under wraps until that character was released in the public domain, because Steamboat Willie is alive and well in film images within this film and as a character. So I'm so looking forward to speaking with Simon, and I'm sure so many of you are anxious to hear what he has to say about expeditiously getting this film out to all of you. And, you know, it's on VOD and digital tomorrow. And then next week, you can get a DVD and Blu-ray. Ooh. But before we get to Simon Phillips, who, and this will be his third time back, so I'm very excited. You know I love repeats. First, for all you classic film fans, Elizabeth Taylor fans, all my TCM peeps out there, Elizabeth Taylor, The Lost Tapes, director, writer, executive producer, Nanette Burstein. I spoke with Nanette about 10 days ago about this documentary. This will blow your minds, people. These are newly discovered, never before heard audio tapes from a 1964 interview between Elizabeth Taylor and Life Magazine's Richard Merriman. After his passing, his widow, and you're going to hear Nanette talk about this, his widow found all of these tapes. And you're going to hear how they made their way to Nanette and how she then culled through 40 hours of Elizabeth Taylor talking. And what is so beautiful, and I know classic film fans are going to be chomping at the bit as they hear Elizabeth speaking and hear excerpts of these 40 hours. Needless to say, there's still a lot more that Nanette did not include in this documentary. But a lot of the time, Roddy McDowell, her bestie, was sitting there with her. And you could hear Roddy asking questions that after a lifetime of knowing each other, he still didn't even know about her. Married with the audio are film clips, archival clips and images, archival interviews with people like Richard Burton, Debbie Reynolds, George Hamilton, just so many. And some of, you know, culling out, you're going to hear Nanette talk about how she selected what film clips, what films to showcase in terms of marrying it with the audio that was available. So you've got Butterfield 8. You've got Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, which of course coincides with the death of Mike Todd, Elizabeth's husband at the time. Cleopatra Chaos and her pneumonia, Suddenly Last Summer. This is just so wonderfully done. I can't tell you how exciting it was for me as a classic film devotee, and a film historian to hear all of these, and to see a lot of these home movies, many of which were Roddy McDowell's, many of which were Elizabeth's, and the fact that the Elizabeth Taylor estate opened up their archives to Nanette. And as you'll hear me find out, they did not open up the jewelry vault. But that's okay. So I think you're going to love this interview with Nanette. I know you're going to love the documentary, which is out now on HBO Max. It was released on Saturday. So without further ado, take a listen to my exclusive interview with Nanette Burstein talking about the new documentary, Elizabeth Taylor, The Lost Tapes. Hey, Nanette.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. What a film you have put together. Wow.
Well, thank you.
Classic film fans are going to go berserk for this documentary.
I certainly hope so. I'm a classic film fan, and I went berserk when I found out I could make this documentary.
I was going crazy watching this, and I'm so invested with TCM over the decades and with the festival every year. And this, to me, is like, this is better than a pot of gold at the end of a rainbow.
Well, it is like opening that treasure when you get the boxes of reel-to-reel tapes of these recordings. It's sort of what it felt like.
And I can only imagine, because there were, about 40 hours of Merriman's interviews?
Yes, there were about 40 hours of Richard Merriman, this journalist who was ghostwriting a book about her, had recorded their conversations for research.
40 hours is nowhere near in this documentary. So we could have director's cut after director's cut and DVD Blu-ray bonuses.
That's true. Do they still have DVD Blu-ray? I don't even know.
DVD and Blu-ray with bonus? Oh, yeah. Yep.
Okay. Yes, absolutely. There are other things that we couldn't fit into the movie.
How did these audio tapes even come to you?
Well, what happened is, after Richard Merriman's death, his wife discovered these reel-to-reel tapes recordings in their attic, and it came to the attention of her estate that they existed. And then they reached out to my producers, who reached out to me, and that's how I got involved. And I happen to be a classic cinema fan. I had watched many of Elizabeth's movies, so I was thrilled at the idea of getting to hear this treasure trove of candid recordings from a megastar who's speaking from beyond the grave. And yes, there's 40 hours, so there's a lot of conversation that's not that interesting too, but there was so many gems that I thought, okay, there's definitely an amazing movie to be made here. So that's how it happened.
How did you even start culling down the audio? Because obviously the way this is structured, the way that you have structured the doc is your visuals correspond with the audio. So it's like chicken and the egg. Did you have dream visuals that you wanted first and then find the audio to fit with that? Or did you have the interview excerpts first and then find the visuals to go with that?
You know, the interviews started the structure of the story. I listened to the tapes. I had them transcribed. I made selects. And I put an outline together of what I thought the story would be, which wasn't that far off from what it ended up being. But then as you start cutting, you're like, okay, this story is great, but it's really detailed and I don't have enough visuals to really make it come to life, or I should tighten it up, or other moments where you don't even need her narration and the visuals speak for themselves. Like for example, you know, she's getting married to Michael Wilding and it's like you feel like you're watching the Beatles show up in New York City. I mean, it's the most insane event with the crowds. And there's no dialogue from her. It's just its own scene. And that happens a bunch where the visuals play their own voice separate from the audio as well.
This obviously is so research intensive to find all of these film clips to get the licensing through.
And then so many of these home movies. I love Roddy McDowall's home movies. I knew Roddy, and he was notorious for he loved filming. So I was happy to see so many of his home movies in there. A lot of Elizabeth's own home movies. What was this research like to accumulate all of this stuff that is not out in the public domain?
Well, I have a great team of people that I work with, so that's very helpful. I have an amazing archivist, Timothy Moran. But also, in this particular case, the estate is extremely well organized, and while they have their own personal archive of Elizabeth, which they shared with us, they've also cataloged a lot of what exists. Not everything. We found a lot of stuff outside of their catalog, but it was a great jumping off point because they've spent a lot of time and effort and work to have organized this and put it into a digital format, and they were very generous collaborators in that sense. And, you know, they gave me creative control.
Wow.
They also gave me the keys to the castle.
Did they give you the keys to the jewelry?
I wish.
Darn. Darn.
I wish. No, I would be just glowing right now. I'd have to go on camera for this podcast.
How did you go about deciding what to include? Because with 40 hours of Elizabeth talking, there's got to be so much in there, and I just feel like you had to be like having to choose among your children, kill your darlings, to decide what you were going to include. Obviously, you have some of the very seminal moments in her career: Butterfield 8, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, the Cleopatra chaos.
Yeah.
Obviously, her childhood with National Velvet, working with Roddy, Lassie movies, and then all the ingenue stuff that popped up. But how did you decide what to include in terms of the film, what the public knows, and then what we had never heard from her before that corresponded?
Well, you know, I kind of had a North Star for her story, especially after listening to the tapes and, you know, all the books I read about her, watching all of her movies. And that was, you know, there was definitely an arc to her story. And it was really about what it was like to be a woman in the latter half of the 20th century who is powerful, who is a megastar, and who is still treated like a harlot publicly,
yeah.
Who is blood-shamed, who is meant to feel insecure because she thinks that that she is judged as a sex symbol as opposed to a really talented actress, despite all of her Oscar nominations and 2 Oscar wins and phenomenal performances. And also it was about the beginning of modern celebrity. So fame became this horrible, difficult, challenging thing for her, much in the way it did for, say, Princess Diana. It was on that level. But then in the 1980s, she figured out that she could use her fame to do the most incredible thing with her life, or in her mind, what was the most incredible thing, which was her philanthropic work.
Mm-hmm.
She paid millions of dollars for AIDS when nobody else was getting involved or even wanting to talk about it. And this was something that was extremely important to her. A lot of her best friends were queer in Hollywood. They had to suffer through being at least publicly closeted for decades, and she was most proud of that. So there were these narrative points that I really wanted to hit on, and that she fortunately spoke so candidly on. There are also, you know, there's some stories that I didn't include I watched all these interviews with her. I'm like, oh my God, she's said this story so many times. And it felt almost canned. Like, you know, it's like the stories we tell, we just keep telling them in this way. And this felt like one of them. Like, there's this famous story where she tells Mayer, like, basically to get lost. She tells him off as a child actress when he is he's screaming at her mother in this meeting, and she doesn't get fired. But she just tells the story the same way in every single interview she's ever done. And I just didn't find it particularly revealing or exciting. To, like, go back to your point of, like, what did I want to share? It was those insights about her that we hadn't known and heard.
What's really interesting that buttresses Elizabeth's own words and the footage that you have is also hearing interviews from her contemporaries, hearing the actual interviews, things that Debbie Reynolds had to say during her lifetime, George Hamilton, Richard Burton, Roddy McDowall, of course. So I found that really interesting, who you included and the interview excerpts that you had of them that filled in so beautifully.
Yeah, I mean, we did it judiciously because I wanted Elizabeth to be the main narrator, but there is things, you know, you need that 360 kind of perspective, and some of her contemporaries allowed for it, and they were saying it, you know, some of them from the grave as well. Some of these were older interviews that we used off screen. Also, when Richard Merriman, the journalist, was recording with her, a lot of times Roddy McDowall would be there.
Yep.
He was just hanging out, or Richard Burton would be there hanging out. So a lot of their thoughts were also captured on these tapes.
And I love it because when she says certain things, and I know Roddy's in the room because I could hear him laughing. And he had a very distinct...
Yes. More than Merriman was.
And
half the time he was the interviewer.
And I love that.
They were so close. They had such a, you know, they really were best friends. And you could hear it on the tape, the way that they spoke to each other. Close.
Whenever she would say something and that he found funny, and you could hear him laugh. And it's, he had the most indelible and infectious laugh. And that just tickled me to no end. But yes, hearing Roddy asking her questions, and some of them, the fact that he said, you know, I don't think we've ever talked about this, but in their whole lifetime, there were still things that he was discovering about her. And that is really interesting.
It's rarely like you have this canvas where, you know, she's sitting down being interviewed for a research on a book project. You know, normally you chat with your friends, even if you're divulging things. Like this is more like, let's go through your whole life. And he's sitting there a lot of the time, so he's like, wow, that's an interesting thought. And
yeah,
I'll follow up with a question.
I'm curious, because George Hamilton is one of the people that is still alive. Did you ever think about reaching out to him to get any kind of current comments to insert?
We did. You know, the interview that we had of him, the estate had done it about a decade before, and it was really good, and it had the salient points that we needed. We did do a couple of interviews of our own as well. I mean, usually I do all my interviews, so this was a different kind of project, but, we didn't feel like we could beat what we had already, given his age now.
Yeah. Then. Talk to me about the editing process on this. This had to be an editing nightmare of epic proportion.
I never consider editing a nightmare. I consider it a joy. I love editing. I started as an editor. And, I mean, a nightmare is when you have nothing to use. You know, there's no visual. No, you don't have this material. I mean, what we had, a treasure trove. So it was really about fitting all the pieces together. I think, you know, the biggest challenge to the film was, okay, all these recordings are in in the 1960s, but we don't want to just end her life here. There's a whole coda to the story, and figuring it how to end the film. Which we did when we found this interview that she did with Dominic Dunn in the 1980s.
And I love that you extended it into that period, because that's when all of her philanthropic work really came into play. And it would have been a shame to not include that. I do notice you omitted the Fortensky days.
It wasn't a cradle to grave story. And, you know, we wanted to really highlight the philanthropic work as well as her rehab stint and as well as her independence, like learning to be single for the first time in her entire adult life. Those were the salient points that we wanted to make, but not every single beat of her life.
Right. And some of them would have just been rehashing tabloid-esque garbage.
Been tawdry for the sake of being tawdry, and that wasn't of interest to us.
You've got beautiful scoring happening here. Logan
Nelson. I know. My composer is a genius. Young man, too. He's great.
What were you looking for musically to envelop, to blanket this wonderful story?
You know, we wanted sort of a classic cinema score, but there was also a little dreamy and hallucinogenic and dark at times and moodier, so like a more contemporary version of classic cinema score.
What Logan gave you is just absolutely beautiful, and it never overpowers anything. I like your sound mix here so that her words are never muted, muffled, covered up. The score, it's a soft undercurrent, and it's really beautiful. So I
know. I think I agree. I agree.
Now that you have listened to all 40 hours, you've put this documentary together, what was the biggest thing that surprised you, as you are a classic film fan and as you have seen so many of Elizabeth Taylor's films? What really surprised you?
Surprised me was her own inner life, her own reflection of herself, how critical she was of herself, how she thought she wasn't pretty inside, that people thought she was immoral, that people didn't think she was a talented actress, that they thought she was a sex symbol or a movie star. You know, she was someone who'd been nominated for Academy Award multiple times, had won twice, was legendary, had done so many brilliant performances, and yet she was very punishing on herself. And understandably to a degree, I mean, being a woman who's reaching for edgy roles in that era, you're bound to get pounded, especially when you have a salacious private life that's now become very public. And she still did it anyway. She's like, I don't care. I'm going to live the life I want to live. But she suffered the consequences emotionally from that.
Is there anything you did not include that you really wanted to, but opted not to or couldn't?
Yeah, there were a couple of stories that she just didn't talk about in the tapes, which I don't know why Merriman didn't ask her, but, or maybe she didn't want to. You know, for example, there is a story of, and it's a famous story, she was so close to Monty Cliff.
Yeah.
And when he was having dinner at her house, he left, and he was a big drinker. They were all big drinkers. He was especially a big drinker. And he got into, and they were up in the hills, and he got in a horrible car accident that disfigured him, and he had the plastic surgery, and he was never, and then she came down and saw him. So that story just did not exist in the tape, so we couldn't use it.
Wow.
She didn't talk about it, you know. So things like, you know, there's just a couple of moments that seemed important to her life that she just didn't speak about.
Yeah, I was surprised to not hear anything about that, because their friendship, they were so close, and this was such big news for years and still talked about.
We never talked about it with anyone else either. Publicly. Like, we looked at other, you know, interviews that she did, and she just never spoke about it. She spoke about it in a book or an article, but she never in any recorded
interview
way.
How are you going to top this, Nanette? How are you going to top Elizabeth Taylor?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm doing a film about Carl Sagan now, so we'll see if it tops that, but it'll hopefully be as good at the release. It's a different subject. It's about the existence it's a love story, but it's a love story with science, and then just a love story, period.
So you go from a movie star to a man who talks about the stars.
That's right. That's right. You know, and it's funny because, I mean, probably won't use this quick, but when he was a kid, his mother took him to the library, and he asked the librarian for a book about stars, and she gave him a book about Greta Garbo and Elizabeth Taylor.
Oh!
Like, no, not those stars.
Oh, that is...
the ones in the sky.
Oh, that's adorable. I love that. Nanette, thank you so, so much. I know... everybody who's got Max, they can see this August 3rd. I'm hoping at some point, because everything is under the Warner umbrella now, I'm hoping it'll air on TCM at some point for people. But and I do want a DVD and or a Blu-ray with all kinds of extras.
Okay. All right. We'll work on that.
Thank you so much, Nanette. And I hope I get to talk to you again in the future about Carl Sagan.
I hope so, too.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And that was my exclusive interview with director, writer, executive producer Nanette Burstein talking about the incredible documentary Elizabeth Taylor, The Lost Tapes. It is now streaming HBO Max. See it. You will, as I said, classic film fans, TCM fans, Elizabeth Taylor fans, you will love this documentary. And to hear Elizabeth Taylor speaking about so many decades of her life in her own voice, in essentially casual conversation with not only Mr. Merriman, the journalist, but also with Richard Burton, with Roddy McDowall hanging out in the room with her. And you'll even hear her saying, is the tape machine on? Is it because she wanted these things to be captured. Just eye-opening. And I do hope we get to see a Blu-ray DVD with a lot more on it, because there's nowhere near 40 hours in this doc. So we're going to switch gears now. And I'm beyond happy, thrilled, and excited to welcome the brilliant Simon Phillips. Hello, my darling.
Hello, Debbie. How are you?
I am fine. I am so happy to have you back on the show.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for having me again.
Well, you know, you promised me. I said, I got to talk to you about this. And months ago, you said, oh, you will. You will.
Well, and here we are.
Here we are. Well, I have to tell you, first of all, let's clarify the name of this film. Is it The Mousetrap? Is it Mickey's Mousetrap? What is the final name of this film?
The final name of the movie, here's the confusing thing, Debbie.
Yes.
The final name of it in this country, in America, is The Mousetrap.
Okay.
Now, other countries are going with the original title because they like it, but that's up to them. Each country is different and what they feel works better. So that does happen with movies sometimes. They get titled different things in different places.
Because I'm looking at the poster, the one sheet, and it's got Mickey's Mousetrap, and then some of the press materials that Annie sent out. It says The Mousetrap, and I'm just like, well, I'm just going to have Simon clarify this.
Well, so, yes, The Mousetrap, anyway, is for all United States purposes, is The Mousetrap.
And for all of you people, all of my audience in Italy and overseas, it will be Mickey's Mousetrap. Just so you
will. It will be later on, but it won't be available for a few months there.
Well, that's okay. We get it first.
Yes.
And you know, it can just be a burr in Disney's backside. Because it's got to be.
Yes. I imagine we are very, very annoying. But you know what? If it wasn't us, it'd definitely be somebody else.
That's just it. And now this begs the question, because when you dropped the trailer for this early in the year, right after Disney's beloved Steamboat Willie, the first iteration of Mickey Mouse, when that came into the public domain on January 1st, you dropped this first trailer very quickly after that and sent the internet a buzz and a Twitter. It's like, oh my God. And a lot of people don't really understand how things come and go in the public domain. And it's like, look, Mickey Mouse is still around. You know, how come all of a sudden? Well, because this iteration is not Mickey as we know Mickey. But you were so far ahead of the curve, Simon. And you shot this back in 2023, last summer.
Yes.
So I'm curious, what was it that sparked this idea for you? Obviously, you were paying attention to things that are popping up and entering the public domain, properties that are entering the public domain that you might be able to utilize for a story idea. So,
yes, I mean, I was just looking ahead, Debbie, which we all should do every now and then. So I was looking ahead. I had seen that some people, I'm sure you're aware of this other movie, had made a Winnie the Pooh,
yes,
Blood and Honey, like a horror movie about the Winnie the Pooh character. And I was like, what a fantastic idea. Maybe not a good, fantastic movie, but a fantastic idea for sure. And I was like, and then I looked ahead and I was like, Mickey Mouse is coming into public domain in January of 2024. So when I was in the summer of 2023, I approached Jamie Bailey, the director, and I was like, hey, I've had this crazy idea, you know, sort of, and I think I won't be the only person that does something like this. And to my shock and surprise, we were the only people that did that.
That utterly amazes me, Simon, that other people have not jumped on the bandwagon, or maybe they have, but they're so...
Well, they have. What it is that they have now,
but they hadn't thought of it before.
They hadn't thought of it before, which is sort of weird because they certainly had the opportunity to think that.
Well,
didn't do it.
Well, see, now, knowing that you look ahead, this now just makes my mind reel because I'm sure you are keeping track of certain things that may be coming into the public domain. With your creative mind, I can see you checking off the list in advance of other potential things that you could do.
Well, yes. I mean, we should keep an eye on everything, really. So I'm not saying that's the only place I look for these things, but it's one of the places that,
yeah,
you know, you can get ideas from.
So now, when you got the idea to make a film, what took you down this horror route with, and there is some comedy in here, just because of the characters that we have. Such as we've got two detectives here. They have to be the worst detectives on the planet.
I'll tell them you said that. I know these guys.
Yeah. You know, they are just Nick Buscopek and Demir Kovic as these two detectives that are interviewing a prisoner. One surviving person after madness and mayhem at,
yes,
this funhouse mousetrap. And I love the structure that you've come up with, Simon, to set the stage with that. And it's through their questioning of her, of Rebecca, who's brilliantly,
yes,
played by Mackenzie Mills. She's wonderful.
Yeah, she's wonderful, isn't she?
And to structure this so that she's in a cell, they're questioning her. Of course, I don't know what kind of jail this is because it looks like an underground gulag or something. With all the stone, cave-like walls and things. But that takes us into, as she's trying to answer their questions, that takes us back into what transpired, what landed her in jail, and what all happened. So I love that structure. I love that structure that you came up with. But how did you...
Yeah, so it...
Go ahead. Tell me more.
Well, we should always be suspicious in any scenario where there's a sole survivor, because a sole survivor is the only person able to tell you what happened, you know, sort of. So there's no corroborating that story because nobody else can tell you the story. So it's we play along with that wonderfully, and she's sort of our narration to the story. This interview sort of punctuates the story, sort of. So. It's a nice device to use, and Mackenzie is able to play it, you know, coyly and suspiciously,
yes,
enough that it's entertaining. So you have to wonder what it is she wants and so on.
Yeah.
Without giving anything away.
No, you and I don't do spoilers. So
we don't.
We don't. But so how did you come up with all of the ideas? You've got a birthday party for somebody turning 21 in this glorified Dave and Buster's. You know,
yes.
That's like the closest analogy for people. It's a glorified Dave and Buster's. So there's going to be an after hours 21st birthday party. And you, as the manager of this fun-loving facility, your big concern is everybody who works there, only two employees, one of which takes off to go hook up with her boyfriend, make sure everything is clean, make sure you close everything down, you know, just very matter of fact. And and you go into your office and you're entertained watching the internet. And of course, what are you watching? What does everybody watch when they have nothing better to do? You watch Steamboat Willie videos.
That's right.
And
well, it was on an old, we had it on an old movie projector.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was, that gave us the inspiration that, you know, he, some magic happened and the character leapt out of the screen and into my character's body, if you like.
Well, doesn't Mickey or Steamboat Willie, don't they always leap off the screen into our imaginations?
Exactly. See, you totally get it. I mean, you get it.
I get it. But then you
get it.
Then you create all of the, you really dig into this group of friends. You really set us up with character traits of each one. You know, who's hooked up, who's jealous, who's just an obnoxious, jerky jock, who's the shy guy who really is crushing on the birthday girl. You really give us a lot of meat for these characters. And then things start happening, and they start disappearing.
Well, that's partly, yes, you know, sort of. So I'm a big fan, Debbie, of 90s, like, slasher movies, like 90s horror movies. Like, I Know What You Did Last Summer, the Scream movies, anything that has a sort of a bit of a wink and a nudge to the camera. Sort of, so that when we made this, I kind of wanted to make it, in a, as you say, a glorified Dave and Buster's. And that was because I like those environments to be fun. Like, that's where adults still go to have fun, you see, sort of. So it should be a safe space, but also it's a bit like a children's playground still. So to me, that was kind of, that worked very nicely with what we were doing. That's why it happens there. So, yes, you know.
And there are so many places to get lost in, within one of those places.
Yes, and that's what that was good. It had a, like a laser tag or a roller coaster or, you know, there's lots of ins and outs of the place, a jungle gym, you know, and that's what made it fun. Lots of places for people to get lost, lots of places for people to get, you know, hunted and maybe picked off one by one.
Now, I've got to ask you, was this an existing facility somewhere, or did your production designer, did Jesse Edwards, have to build this and design this from the ground up?
Oh, no, no, no. We didn't have that kind of budget to do that. So we had to find somewhere that had to, you know, I went around and I found, before I wrote the script, I found the location so that I would know what I could do, like what my limitations were. So, like, I was, you know, I was delighted to find somewhere with a roller coaster and a laser tag room and a jungle gym and an arcade. You know, I needed all, as many little corners and as many little bits as possible. And I found it.
Wow. And you utilize every single piece of the of that facility.
Yeah. Well, yes. I mean, that was the plan. You know, sort of. So yeah. You know, it's just, that was there, but it was based on me knowing what existed already. So, like, in fairness to them, I reverse engineered it a little bit, knowing what was there. We wrote the story around it so we could maximize all of it.
Well, you certainly did, and this is where Jamie Bailey is your director and his cinematographer and his editor. This is where his work is very important because you got to look at, number one, the camera work is excellent. We get a lot of really great camera angles that divvy things up, make things look more ominous or more foreboding, and on the flip side, more innocent than things really are. But lighting becomes critical here. using the blues, then using reds and oranges. The lighting design is superb. I am so in love with it because it adds so many layers and textures to this story, Simon.
For sure. Yeah, for sure. It's multi-layered, but what Jamie Bailey, and Jamie, going back to your original thing there, Jamie Bailey had a lot of fun here because the arcade, or the glorified Dave and Buster's, as you coined it, it's full of neon lights. So it's, you know, sort of, there's a lot of fun a cinematographer can have playing with that sort of. So, we were like big kids in the playgrounds, Debbie. So that's, we were playing dress up. We had a ridiculous idea and we just went with it.
And let me guess, you were the biggest kid of all.
Well, I'm playing Mickey Mouse. So I was like, so who better?
Oh my God. Now, with this location, because of the way Jamie has shot it, were you running into challenges with logistics for the camera setups, lighting, or were you shooting, you know, handheld stuff? Because for some of the places where you are, I'm imagining that he was going handheld or Steadicam.
A variety of things. So he did have, there was some limitations as in, the biggest problem was sound. It's very noisy in arcades. So we had to work very hard to turn the sound of all the machines off, but keep the lights on, which, you know, if you've ever been in these things, they're very noisy environments. So that was the biggest problem. Now, visually, it wasn't, he had a lot of fun camera-wise. He just had, sound-wise, it was a bit of a challenge.
Okay, well, you having now said that about the sound is wonderful.
They did a lot of work to make sure it was all right.
Oh, my God. The sound is just wonderful, Simon.
Good. Well, I'm glad you liked that.
Well, I liked it because, and this is where the sound mix is also important, because we can hear all the dialogue. You've got a great score. Your score is great. Darren Moore did your score, and I really like the score. But the mix, so we're not hearing the machines. We're not hearing the arcade stuff. We're not even before Madness and Mayhem takes place, and they're playing the basketball thing, shoot it in the basket. I can't. The only thing I can do in an arcade is skee ball. But they're doing that, and we don't hear the machines then. So it's quiet. We hear them yelling, talking. You've got foreground and background sound happening, but we don't lose any dialogue. And the score doesn't step on anything, and everything works together. So I'm really impressed with that sonic level of the film. Really well done.
Yeah, well, thank you, and we hope so.
You really, really did a great job with this. Now, in addition to being the writer and playing Mickey.
And Mickey.
Yes, being the writer and playing Mickey. You're also producer. So
yes.
So how involved were you in the production elements? Obviously, you had the forethought for this story. You had the forethought to go find the locations so that you could write the story. How boots on the ground were you in terms of those day-to-day producing choices that must be made?
Oh, yeah, it was me. As I said, the project was totally reverse engineered there a little bit. So I kind of knew what we could play with because I had to do it for writing the script. But then I also negotiated with the location for the agreement to let us film there. And, you know, at Funhaven in Ottawa in Canada, which is where it shot. So the day-to-day logistics, they all fall to me. I have a lot of help, obviously. So there are other producers and people that help in the meantime. So it is just me telling people sometimes to help out. But it falls to me, Debbie, I'm afraid. There's nobody else, really. Myself and Jamie are the ones that drive it forward.
Well, you have driven it really well. You've driven it across the finish line. You know, those bells and whistles.
Good. I'm glad to hear that.
I love it. I've watched it twice already.
You have? Oh, wonderful.
Because I thought it was just so much fun. You know, how challenging was the casting here? Because you really needed to get a group of people that would feel like they'd been friends forever.
Yeah, well, like that 90s slasher movie that we were trying to ape, you know, mm-hmm. sort of that we were trying to get into, into the spirit of we identified, like, well, we want the hockey guy, we want the popular girl, we want the love interest, we want the geeky guy, you know, we want the gothic girl. You know, we wanted a wide array of characters, but obviously they had to be roughly the same age because they had to be believably friends. And then they had to be, you know, cohesive together, which is something is hard to predict whether they were. But we just, you know, we got a good bunch of very young cast. You know, some of these guys, it's their first movie. Mm-hmm. So they did very well over night shoots because this was all filmed at night when the arcade was closed to the public. And we obviously filmed nights over a couple of weeks. So they did very well to do that on their first shoot altogether. They were just thrown in the deep end and they handled it marvelously.
Well, I mean, Sophie McIntosh, who plays our birthday girl, Alex, and an employee at Funhaven, she's lovely. She is just lovely.
She's a very talented, definitely young girl. I don't think it was her first film. Sorry, I was referring to some of the others. But she had the good gravitas that we needed that character to have. Mm-hmm. You had to sort of be on her side. She sort of the audience's eyes and ears a little bit.
And, of course, the one in addition to Mackenzie's work is Rebecca. I really love what Callum Sywick brought to Marcus. Such,
yes,
oh, my absolutely. God.
So, he was a wonderfully able guy to be that kind of geeky thing. He just embodied that completely. It's a bit like he's like that in real life. So I was just able to, he was good enough to be able to act like that too. So he's very gentle, very kind person.
How long was the casting process for this one?
We cast like over a month. We were casting out of Ottawa in Canada, which is where we were filming. So we saw a lot of people for sure. But over about a month we had it, just in the run up to the shoot. So it was pretty last minute, if you were, like, you know.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Now, was it difficult to cast Mickey? I mean, really, that is a critical part. Was it difficult to cast Mickey?
Well, as myself, no, it was pretty easy, Debbie. I didn't have to do a lot of work. In fact, it was the only thing I wanted out of the whole thing. I was like, I'm going to play Mickey.
Oh, my God.
You know, Jamie was like, well, it's a guy in a mask. It could be any guy. And you're like, you know, it doesn't have to be you. And I was like, no, I know. But, there's a certain way to be intimidating on screen that isn't, you know, like when you're not talking and when you're not violent, you know, there's a way to move your head slowly that makes it eerie. Mm-hmm. You know, when somebody comes up and says, what's wrong with you? And you don't respond, but your head moves just a little bit. It kind of looks creepy. But that's a very hard thing to direct another actor to do. It's like you either know what to do or not. Simon's done his fair share of intimidating roles.
Oh.
It seemed easy.
You think? Just a few. But, you know, you balance all of those intimidating roles with, you know, things like, you know, playing a king in a Hallmark Christmas movie and, you know, wonderful
yes.
things. But then you also have been a very intimidating Santa in several Christmas horror movies.
Well, indeed. I like subverting people's expectations that I can do the Hallmark. This year, Debbie, I'm doing a Hallmark movie, which is coming out. I've already done it. And a Christmas horror movie that they probably end up releasing in the same week.
Oh, my God. I'm so excited. But now, another movie that came out just before The Mousetrap is Blood and Snow. Finally.
Oh, yes.
Finally got to see it on Amazon because I kept trying because it was supposed to be on Amazon and they kept saying it's not available, it's not available, it's not available. Finally, I got to see it. A sci-fi film. And you are actually the sane one in this entire thing. I had so much fun watching Blood and Snow, and you're also a co-writer on it. You play the character of Luke. You, once again, you're in the film with Vernon Wells.
I love Vernon.
I love Vernon, too. And Jesse Palangio directs it. Talk to me about Blood and Snow. We're going to do a twofer here today. We're going to do Mousetrap and we're going to do Blood and Snow. Talk to me about coming up with this one. I love the sci-fi aspect. You've got some great themes going in there and some wonderful undercurrent of corporate crap that's being done. So talk to me about where this one came from, because I really like it.
Well, I took my jump off point. I'm sure you've seen the old John Carpenter movie with Kurt Russell, The Thing.
Yep.
And that was our sort of, I really liked that sort of story, just about being isolated in the cold, you know, far away from anybody else, you know, sort of it presents, that's its own sort of horror film right there. It's being, lots of my movies, as I'm sure you appreciate, Debbie, are about people being trapped somewhere,
yeah.
Like, you know, they're isolated, because that helps the story, you know. They can't call for help, because help's too far away. So it doesn't make a... It's not conducive to the scenario. But so Blood and Snow was that. It was like, what happens with these guys if, you know, if they get into trouble? So they have to kind of figure it out themselves. And I quite liked the idea. I'm a big fan of another old 90s movie, Species. I don't know if you ever saw that one.
Yes.
You mix The Thing with Species. Like that, in a bunch of guys, there's one girl, and the girl is very dangerous.
And that is certainly what we have here with Blood and Snow. But here again, I love the intricacy of, number one, the production design and the layout of this compound where everybody is in the snow suits this really well with the individual characters and people getting separated from each other within there, and you don't know where they are and you're trying to find them. Or they're in a tunnel and nobody will open a door to let you in. That was a great scene, by the way.
Oh, yeah. I loved that. So that's me.
But
you know, sort of.
The great thing here, we've got Vernon, of course, playing the professor, as he well should. But you are the loose cannon that nobody likes. They don't trust you. They think that you're a raving nut. When you are the one who is actually the only one making any sense about the situation and what needs to be done.
Yes, that people just don't like it because my character is definitely a little anti-woke. You
yes.
know, sort of, so they're like, oh, well, he's Simon's character is just a bit of a woman hater. But in this scenario, of course, I'm correct. And I was like, don't hate her because she's a woman. I hate her because I think there's something wrong and you guys are just not seeing it. You know, it's not about her being a woman, it's about her being an alien, you know, like, so they're about her being a murderer,
you know.
Sort of, we can't bully her because she's a woman. My character ends up being right, but obviously nobody wants to listen.
No, and that's what I loved. And you were consistent, as Luke, you were consistent through the entire film, and you did not back down. Luke did not back down. And when everybody finally is like, okay, yeah, maybe you're right, it's like
I know I'm right. It's just a bit too late now. She's got the upper hand now. We had a chance to deal with her when she was incapacitated, but now she's not.
But and here again, you got some great comedy that happens, where all of a sudden she comes out of a coma because she's been out freezing in the snow and for days and is found and comes back and she finally awakens and she's starving, and then she's just chowing down on every MRE meal that anybody can find, and it's not dawning on anybody there's something wrong with this.
For sure.
The only person who says anything is the character of Luke, not even our pot smoking guardian of the food. He just keeps getting her more food. Just so much fun. Now, for you as an actor playing a role like Luke, playing something like Mickey, what kind of challenges, what are the similarities in roles like that for you? And then what are the differences that make you up the ante and push you to go the extra mile?
So you have to, I always, I'm sure you know this, Debbie, but I always play bad guys or a version of a bad guy, if you like. You know, is Luke a bad guy? He's probably not the world's best husband or the world's, but you know, like, and he's a bit anti-women, obviously, sort of. But so he's not he's not killing people type of thing, but he's certainly an undesirable guy. The way I find with every character in everything is to find a way to make them human, you know, sort of. It's like, well, make you have to be able to believe you could, nobody is bad for no reason, you know, sort of. They usually, any bad person throughout all of history usually has a pretty good reason for doing what they're doing, you know, whether that's childhood trauma or their own personal experience or something, you know, like sort of whatever it is. So you just have to find whatever that is and put that into your character and go, yeah, I think my guy doesn't think he's wrong. He's not playing bad. He thinks he's right, you know, sort of. It's just what his reasons are differing, you know, sort of like anybody else might do something different, but it's, you know, that's what makes them believable. You have to, there isn't really good guys and bad guys. There's a bunch of people doing what they think is right.
Because, I mean, you know how much I love all the different characters that you play, Simon.
I do. I'm a very big supporter, and I appreciate that, Debbie.
I just think that, you know, what you bring, you know, going toe-to-toe with Bruce Willis, that's still one of the funniest scenes ever. And
I love it.
I mean, that's hilarious. I love Fubar. I mean, come on, sitting there at a table with Arnold.
What's not to love there?
What's not to love? And then, of course, you know, playing Mickey, a perverted version of Mickey Mouse. Not perverted, but just a twisted perverted version of Mickey Mouse. That just, how can you not... And he has his own limitations, and we're not going to say what it is, but Mickey has his own limitations, and you play that so well, Simon.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you.
So now everybody can see Blood and Snow right now on Amazon. They can
tomorrow
they can see The Mousetrap, VOD and digital. On August 13th, the DVD and Blu-ray drops. Any extras or anything fun in the Blu-ray to look forward to?
Do you know what? I haven't seen it yet. So I don't know what they... We give them a bunch of stuff. I assume it found its way onto the Blu-ray or the DVD. I'm not sure. But time will tell, you know. So I'm always the last to know some of these things. These are all the distributors. They're the ones that do the reps. We just make the movies. I mean, they decide how to put them out there.
Now, where do you know yet where people can buy the DVD and DVD or Blu-ray?
Oh, well, you'll be able to order the DVD and Blu-ray on Amazon that much. I mean, you can order it right now because it's pre-order, so I know if I've seen.
Well, you know what I'm going to go home and do today.
Well, if you have VOD, you can just see it tomorrow. But, I mean, it depends on how you... I mean, I love physical media.
That's it.
Know, so I like the old school. That's just me, you know. So
that's what I like, which is why I'm going to have to order me a DVD Blu-ray so that I have it forever. So when it gets dropped from a streaming platform, as so many people are finally discovering that just because it's streaming does not mean it's going to stay there. So
that's also very true.
So if you really love it, you need to buy it and have it in your own personal collection so you can watch it anytime you choose. But this is just, The Mousetrap is so much fun, Simon.
Well, I'm glad you think so. And you know, Debbie, we had a ridiculous idea, which is ridiculous, and we had a lot of fun making it. And that's why, I want people to have fun watching it. I was like, don't worry, we didn't take it too seriously. We knew what we were making, and we had plenty of fun doing it. And why not?
And that's it. And why not? So now what do we have next besides your Christmas movie, your nice Christmas movie, your horror Christmas movie? What else is coming up?
Well, that Silent Bites, that my horror Christmas movie and my Hallmark Christmas movie, those are two movies. I wasn't involved in like I was involved in The Mousetrap. But, you know, there are two movies that are coming out later this year. One's called Silent Bite, and the other one's called, the Hallmark one is called Hocus Pocus Christmas. You know, that's going to be a Hallmark movie.
Wow. Yeah, Hallmark likes you. See,
they do.
They do. I mean, you play a king. You were wonderful playing a king.
I think I told you, Debbie, I made everyone refer to me as King Simon for about a month, all my family and everything.
Well, as well you should.
I know. I mean, they don't think that.
Well, I think that.
But I do.
I mean, it was such a departure from what they're used to seeing you as. You know, you deserve that recognition. You know, hey,
well,
what?
Again, I believe so.
Well, I believe it too. And now, Hocus Pocus Christmas. Sounds like that should be coming from Disney with, you know, Bette Midler and Sarah Jessica Parker and Kathy and Jimmy for a third Hocus Pocus.
I know what you mean, although I don't know if I'm ever going to work for Disney after this.
Yeah, that could be problematic. But hey, you waited and you kept this thing under wraps until after January 1st. That had to have been difficult, Simon.
It was, because I was very excited to tell people about it, Debbie. But also, it was a bit of a top-secret project because anybody could have done it. You know, so I mean, I know a lot of my friends and stuff like that are filmmakers. So not to be too paranoid, but I was like, if I tell people this great idea, someone else might go and do it. It was two reasons. Number one, I couldn't really tell people about it because it wasn't in public domain yet. But number two, somebody could take your idea, obviously, because it wasn't. I couldn't accuse them of stealing. I was already using something that wasn't mine. So you have to be careful on two fronts there.
Well, now, how did the strike impact? Did the SAG strike impact you at all?
Well, this was shot in Canada, so it's not part of. So we get around that by it not being in America. So we're actually that didn't affect us on that time.
Oh, smart, very smart.
Yeah, well, that was very lucky.
So
very lucky for sure.
Have you gotten any further on doing some kind of sequel to Stealing Chaplin?
There's stuff still in the work on that one. So yes. Yeah, and no, at the same time, you know, so we're not shooting it just yet. However, there's plenty of chat about it for sure.
Do you have a
back to Vegas?
I know, you know, do you have a script done?
We do have a script done, yes. I'll tell you that.
And you wrote it?
Doug Phillips, who wrote the first one.
Okay.
I just came up with the idea for it.
Okay. You know I'm waiting for that one. You know I'm waiting
know,
for that.
I know, but I can't tell you too much.
That's
about
okay.
That one. They will literally kill me.
As long as I know, I have that to look forward to at some point.
It will definitely find its way somewhere.
Oh, Simon, as always, an absolute thrill and a joy to get to speak with you again. I adore you. I so adore
Thank you. Thank you so much, Debbie, for having us on the show.
And... this film, everybody, they can see it tomorrow. It is so much fun, and it's well done. So, you know, it's a bonus here. It's well done, and it's fun. So, everybody needs to see it. And I can't wait till we get to chat again.
Me too. Honestly, thank you so much, Demi, and I look forward to the next time.
Thank you, Simon, and you take care.
Yeah, thank you. Bye, Debbie.
Bye-bye. And that was Simon Phillips. We have the clarification in the United States. The film is The Mousetrap. It is available tomorrow on VOD and digital. It is on DVD and Blu-ray on August 13th. And when it goes to Europe, it's going to be called Mickey's Mousetrap. So, some great stuff for you to watch out there. Two winners here, Elizabeth Taylor, the Lost Tapes documentary on HBO Max, and The Mousetrap. So, until next week, and again, I don't know who we're having next week. We'll have somebody. Until then, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.